You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to a depressing edition of the Pine Star Podcast, as the Royals are in free fall. It is May, so I think that was to be expected. But we do have good news, because this week we will be joined by two guests, not one, but two guests. We'll start things off here in just a few minutes by bringing in Will Carroll, who is the injury expert with Bleacher Report and newly on MLB Network, which is pretty cool for him. And then we will get to CJ Whitman, who handles the Wilmington area in the Carolina League for Baseball Prospectus. So we'll get some insight on injuries, and the Royals have had a few pitching injuries over the last few days, and then some insight on the young pups down on the farm. So we'll get to that shortly, but before we get to that, I think that we all know that no Pine Tar podcast is complete without the sultry sounds of Clint Scholes. So let's bring him in. Clint, what's going on? How are you?
Oh, I'm recovering from a three-game sweep of the Houston Astros, and I'm kind of depressed because I kind of predicted this. I said May 25th, I feel like a bad stretch is coming, yeah. And we've definitely hit that.
Yeah, it's I will say this: if this is rock bottom for the season, then I still like the Royals' chances. Here's my concern.
This is the start of rock bottom.
Right. The next 12 games, it's four against the Blue Jays, who are on fire. Four against the Cardinals, who are getting better and getting back to being the Cardinals. And four against the Yankees, who are, I don't know how they're as good as they are, but they are pretty good. So that's 12 games that, I don't know about you, but would it shock you if you saw them finishing 2-10 in those 12 games?
It wouldn't shock me if they went 0-12, David.
No, I mean, that would probably shock me just because I don't think they're going to lose 16 in a row. But, yeah, this team is playing about as bad as any team can play right now. And it's a problem. The Houston Astros, one thing I'll say about the Houston Astros, they came into Kansas City. They were 8-6 in the last 14 games. We've talked about it on this podcast. They've been playing better. George Springer is a beast, and he's hitting like even more of a beast right now. But still, you gotta win two games from the Astros at home. I don't think you have to sweep, but you can't get swept, and you probably can't even lose two out of three. And right now, this Royals team, in no way, shape, or form, looks like they can play in the playoffs, unless they play in the playoffs to like 2016.
No, you can't. For one, you can't make the playoffs if you can't score runs.
Well, that too, yeah.
And they've scored 5 runs over 3 days. Say what you want about the Astros. Yeah, they've got George Springer's hitting, and Altuve's a nice player. I think Castro's a nice player. But they let the bottom of the order tear them up as well as the top.
Right, no,
the bottom is for that team is putrid. They feature more 150, 160 hitters than any major league team should. And then to just let them pitch you and dominate you on the mound was ridiculous as well, scoring 5 runs over 3 days.
Yep. And, you look at the series, and Scott, you can look at it rationally and come to the conclusion that, yeah, the Astros played pretty well and the Royals played poorly, and that's all it was. Scott Feldman's not a bad pitcher, and he didn't do well. Colin McHugh has done this to other teams, and Jared Cozart is not great, but not bad either. But at the same time, the Royals are still better than the Astros, or at least they should be. And I think over the course of the season, they are. But they swept the Astros in Houston. The Astros swept the Royals here. It's hard to say right now that the Royals are better than the Astros. And we're at a crossroads, because this is a season that the Royals had to compete. And a lot of things have gone right to get them in a position where they were close about a week ago, but the offense has been heinous, as we know. The starting pitching has been much better, but, well, over the last 3 days, some things have happened, Yordano Ventura is going to miss a start, and we'll talk to Will Carroll about that in a couple minutes. Danny Duffy is dealing with a quote-unquote dead arm right now, and we'll talk about that with Will Carroll also. And you're looking at a rotation now that, I mean, it shields in some questions because Jason Vargas hasn't been as good lately. Jeremy Guthrie is Jeremy Guthrie, and he'll be good sometimes and bad sometimes. And then you've got Duffy and Ventura, and at this point, I'm not expecting a whole lot out of him. If Ventura's pitching, I'll expect a lot out of him. But would it shock you to find out in 3 weeks that he's out for the year?
No.
Yeah.
And I think you'll hear us when we talk with Will, we mentioned that. Danny Duffy scares me a lot because...
Me too.
Because this is two starts in a row, he's looked putrid. I mean, yep. And he was giving up bomb after bomb. The other thing that scares me is the velocity was so far down for him today. You can say it's a dead arm, and maybe it is just fatigue or whatever, but it just doesn't work. The dude's made four starts prior to today. He shouldn't right. He shouldn't be coming in with a dead arm. And that's
although I will say that if he does have a dead arm, this would be about the right time for it because he's only made four starts. This would be the time in spring training when pitchers are starting to stretch out and they go through that dead arm. So the timing does sort of make some sense if that makes you feel any more comfortable about it. But it's never a good sign when you're left-handed power pitcher who sits 94 to 95, 96 is throwing 87 to 91. That's never a good sign.
No, and this team has let a league that is very capable of letting the Royals win the wild card, they've let them get away from it.
Yep.
There's no reason why this offense hasn't been able to score enough runs that they should be leading the second wild card.
Oh, easily.
Right,
and that's what I wrote about. We're recording on Wednesday. I wrote about that this morning. That the Royals, I mean, it's still not too late. They're sitting at 24 and 28 right now and looking like about the worst team in baseball. But it's still not too late because the American League is so freaking mediocre. The Royals need to make a couple moves, like yesterday. And, you know, we can talk about who should be making that move. And I think we both have a similar opinion to that. But that doesn't really matter because they're not getting rid of Dayton Moore. They're not getting rid of Ned Yost right now, although I think his seat is getting hotter. If this team wants to win in 2014, there's still plenty of time. They just have to make some moves instead of counting on guys to do something that is apparently just not going to happen.
Yeah. One move that needs to be made is, and I don't know how you feel, and I'm a big fan of this guy, but Billy Butler needs something needs to happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to do with him.
I think you sign Kendrys Morales and you wave him goodbye. And you let
do you just release Billy Butler?
I think at this point you gotta generate some offense. And this guy has been in a 90-game slump now. This isn't a short slump. And you got an option on him, and you got an option for next year or whatever that you can cut him. And wave the flag. So then wave the flag now. Why wait? You got to put something into this offense.
No, I'd agree with that. I think instead of releasing him, I think somebody's going to trade for Billy Butler. I think you look at...
Why would somebody trade for him? I mean, yeah, you could get nothing. You could get like a C or D prospect.
Well,
yeah.
Sure, but okay. You trade Alberto Callaspo, and yes, he had more value at the time than Butler, so it's not a great example. But turn that into Will Smith. Well, Will Smith became Nori Aoki. I'm not saying you're going to get Will Smith again, but even a low-level guy is better than just releasing him.
Well, I guess, but I just don't know. I guess there's some team out there that might trade for him.
There's something telling me that the Rangers are going to look at what their injuries and say, well, you can't hurt.
Here's the problem with that scenario, David. You can't wait around for it because those same people will look at Kendrys Morales and go sign him.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, and I don't think that... And that's the other problem, too. You've got to sign Morales first and then trade Butler.
Yeah, and at this point, the Royals, I mean, they're going to have to – I think they got to beat the market. Because how do you – so what do you do? You either got to overspend for Morales when everybody is bidding on him after the draft, or you go right now and you toss away your 17th pick. And if I'm Dayton Moore, I'd probably do that because I –
Yeah, if I'm Dayton Moore, I'm – probably general managing for my job, and not this year. But the fact is, the Royals aren't going to win next year, probably, if guys like Kyle Zimmer can't come back and this offense can't get better. And so, yeah, I think Dayton Moore's managing for his job this year so he can have some goodwill for next year's failure.
Yeah, you've watched this team and this offense now for 52 games.
You know what they are.
And this isn't new, all right? Besides Eric Hosmer's resurgence last year in the second half, this offense was basically the same. And so you're either...
Yeah, really, I feel like if Eric Hosmer was hitting for power, that would be the difference between this year and last year.
It would be. And I think...
Ed Butler is he wasn't this bad last year.
No. Well, he was the last 45 games.
Even then he was still getting on base at a decent. You know, you were still getting some hits from him. This year you're not getting any hits from him either.
Yeah, well, he was very putrid that last month of the season. I think that last month of the season he had like a 630 OPS. It was very bad when I was looking at the breakdown of where he's at compared to, you know, that's what I'm talking about. It's the last 80, you know, he's on a 90 game slump right now. I mean, it's very similar to where he was. He's probably, he's a little bit worse this year actually, but it isn't a huge difference if you look at where he really fell off last season.
Yeah, I mean, he had a 291, 345, 350 in September, October. That's not good. But wouldn't you take that right now?
Well, yeah, I'd take that. But I mean, it was bad.
But I'm saying there's the difference. Is that? I mean, I don't even know what to make of this. I've never seen a team go through what the Royals are going through right now. They've got 21 homers through 52 games.
Yeah, and their 21st was by a guy who was 0 for his previous 27.
Well, he had a hit today. Before that, he was 1 for 28.
Yeah, but I'm saying the first home run
right.
In weeks.
I did put some fun little stats in my article this morning that the Royals are on base for less homers than five different seasons in big league history by individuals. They're on pace for less than two teams already have. So yeah, you're right. They need some instant offense. And short of going out and trading for guys, you're right, Candace Morales replacing Billy Butler would give the Royals some offense. My question, and we can talk about this another time probably, my question is, Candace Morales hasn't played. Is he ready to go? I mean, the Red Sox just signed Stephen Drew, and he's got to go down to minor league assignment. What, Candace Morales isn't exactly the physical specimen that Stephen Drew is. So is he going to take a little bit longer? Is he going to be able to come back? I worry about the time off for him more than I would for a guy like Drew.
Well, I see that move as, if I'm Dayton Moore, that's the move I want to make. If I'm David Glass, I say, there ain't hell no, I ain't spending a dime more on this team.
Yeah, I don't blame you. They're going to have to, this 12-game stretch is going to be really big, I think, for the Royals because of that. If they can... I can't even fathom how they would do this, but if they could go 8-4 in these next 12 games and get back to .500, I could see Dayton Moore saying, "Look, we need a push. We need a push. I need you to write another check." And I could see David Glass doing it. But if they go 4-8, there's no way he's spending that money, and he shouldn't.
No, he shouldn't have to spend another dime. I mean, a trade deadline deal was the only way you could expect him to put some extra money to get them over the top into this deal. If I was Dayton, maybe I get in a white van, I get some ski mask on, and I hijack Kevin Seitzer, and I take him to a batting cage with a gun to his head, and I say, "Here, fix these guys right now."
Yeah, I mean, you know how I feel about the hitting coach argument, but obviously he's the only guy who's gotten much out of these guys.
Yeah. So. Oh, I'm not a big fan of that argument either.
No, I know.
Ultimately, it's on these guys. Grifol could be a terrible hitting coach. He could be the worst hitting coach in the world. Then why are you listening to him? Hit the fucking ball.
Yeah, no, you're dead on. Because the fact of the matter is, people talk about Pedro Grifol as the reason. If Pedro Grifol is the reason these guys are struggling, then they suck anyway. I'm sorry. If the hitting, I mean, this guy, he's there to give you guidance if you take it from him. I'm not saying that Pedro, you're right, Pedro Grifol could be awful at his job. We don't really know. It's hard to see that. I mean, Eric Hosmer sang his praises to me during spring training, but the fact is, look what Eric Hosmer's done this year. So, who knows? But the fact is, it's not Pedro Grifol's fault that these guys can't hit the ball more than 330 feet.
No, it's... Eric Hosmer is just... The dude's a mess. He's got a few doubles this year, but he literally looks like a guy who has no ability to hit the ball over the fence.
That's what he looked like last... Remember last year? And Ned Yost went on... I think it was 6'10", and he talked about how he can't even hit home runs in batting practice.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand.
But, you know, he also said that batting practice home runs will translate. So, and Eric Hosmer is apparently hitting the ball very far in batting practice. So I think he should have a second home run by mid-July maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the guy's injured. Maybe we need to get Will Carroll to check on Hosmer's injury status.
Well, let's bring him on now. We'll talk pitching with him now. Maybe next time we'll talk Eric Hosmer's injury status that may or may not be. We are now joined by Will Carroll, who is the injury expert for Bleacher Report and most recently MLB Network, which is pretty awesome. Congrats on that, Will. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. Certainly better than the Royals' arms are doing right now.
Royals' arms, Royals' bats, Royals' everything, whatever. Well, you know, let's dive right in. The biggest issue that Royals fans have had over the last, or the biggest concern Royals fans have had over the last couple of days is rookie stud Yordano Ventura. News came out, luckily, that he's only going to miss one start, but for now,
okay.
The news isn't obviously completely rosy. Can you explain his injury, the lateral elbow soreness?
In simple terms, no, I can't. Here's the thing. The more that I hear, the more that the Royals say, the less I feel that I understand this. And I don't want to blow smoke at you guys and say that I know what's going on when flat out I don't. So let's go with the evidence that we have. This is what I've gotten from both public statements and talking to sources. The first thing is the obvious talk about the lateral arm soreness. Now, the first thing we have to do is figure out, A, what the heck is the lateral portion of the elbow? You know, lateral is just the Latin term for outside. Now, it's very easy to look down at your knee and say, I know where the lateral side is, I know where the medial side is, because that doesn't move a whole lot. But the elbow is complicated. Anatomic position for the elbow is actually as if a body is laying on a table and the palms are up. So if you just kind of put yourself in that position, now, what's the lateral portion is completely different than what most people think it is. So there's definitely some differences there. Once you understand that, now we have to start saying, okay, where is that in relation to the ulnar collateral ligament? And it is on the opposite side. But I'm not sure what that tells us. Because the other thing they told us was the valgus stress overload. Well, guess what? Valgus stress is when you have too much of it, the ulnar collateral ligament snaps. That's not good. You don't want that. You certainly don't want that with a pitcher like Ventura. So you certainly have a situation where two things that the Royals have flat out told us don't add up. If you have a valgus stress overload, why is the UCL so completely intact? Why is there no problem? Don't understand how you put those two together. Now we go off and we get the one start. That indicates there's no inflammation, and that's certainly problematic. If his velocity dropped by over 7 miles an hour from his top, and there's no inflammation, well, what the heck was the problem? Essentially what they've said is it's not a big deal. His velocity dropped for no apparent reason. We have utterly no idea what the causation is. We'll have him back out there in a week.
This kind of reminds me of Danny Duffy and his injury. I think it was he went and basically similar thing, missed one start or maybe two, and then blew out the elbow two starts later. Is this kind of what you're expecting to see possibly as well?
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend that I can predict what's going to happen with Ventura, and I certainly hope he's healthy. Nick Kenny and his staff are top-notch. I mean, they won the award for having the best medical staff a couple of years ago, and I certainly believe they're going to do everything they can to stop it. I'm confused by all the different things they're saying. There's one other additional thing that we heard that's even more confusing, and this is where I thought things were starting to come together. When Ned Yost was talking about banging on the fastball, that's not a terribly clear term. It doesn't mean just one thing, but there's certainly questions about whether or not there's some sort of how to describe this. I guess the best way would be to actually do it with your arm. If there's a hyperextension, then the bones of the arm, the upper arm and the lower arm, are going to bang together, and that's bad. You don't want that. So if that was the situation, that would explain lateral arm pain. That would explain a lot of things. But they're saying that's not what it is. So that portion of the statement just confused me and made this thing even tougher to all put together.
When you talk about banging the fastball, at what point in the arm motion is that getting overextended? Is that at the release point, or is that at a different point?
Usually it's just before release, and you don't want it. That's the thing. If you're extending the arm, you can imagine Ventura's or anybody's release. You can do it with yourself. You can get to that stage right at the release, and the arm's extending, but then you normally pronate and bring it through on the follow-through. You don't want it going full out. You know, a lot of people try to teach a curveball as the motion of a hammer. And if you're swinging a hammer and you don't hit something solid, well, your arm's going to lock out. And if you do it too hard, the bones are going to bang together. That's bad. We see that happen quite a bit. Pitchers that don't pronate well will end up with bone chips or bone spurs because the bone is banging together. In extreme cases, it can even fracture. Cal Eldred's probably the one people know most. He actually fractured that olecranon process and had to have a screw put it back together. And a 5-inch screw in his elbow sounds like a bad thing, but he came back pretty well.
That's true. Cal Eldred had a surprisingly decent career. So this can obviously cause problems in the future for Ventura. What can he do to stop it, if anything?
That's the open question. The problem is that as I said, I don't know what's going on. And I'm not sure the Royals do either. They certainly have more information than we do, but I'm not sure exactly how clear it is. What bending and banging his elbow? Yeah, that's pretty easy to do. You can change that just fairly simply. I think you would almost have to change that. It's tough, especially for a guy like Ventura, who's got such great velocity, has been doing this for a while, to say, hey, change. It's just not that easy, and you're often going to overtax other muscles that aren't as used to the process. So I think what you're looking at is that it's one thing that I don't know, it's one thing that you don't know, but the Royals don't know how much stress Ventura or any of their pitchers is putting on their elbow, on their shoulder, on their back with each and every pitch. And that's something we can do simply and easily and cheaply with a biomechanical analysis. You know, there's one over at the University of Missouri that their lab director would be happy to let the Royals use for a nice, simple cost of about $200 per pitcher. To me, that sounds like a pretty good investment, considering you're going to spend $5 or $6 million on a pitcher in the opening round of the draft, like Kyle Zimmer, he's having some problems of his own. So if we knew exactly what the forces were on Ventura, we would certainly have more information that would allow us to predict, you know, is that elbow going to blow up? If he's putting, you know, 60, 70 newton meters of force on that elbow with every pitch, well, in cadavers, it usually pops about at 32 to 35 newton meters. So if you're doing something that's going to overextend that ligament over and over, I don't think it's going to hold up very long. You can't say when, but you can certainly say there's a much higher risk.
You talk about that biomechanics test, and I think you even told Carrington and them that it cost them about $1 million to set up a lab. Wouldn't it be a no-brainer to just run, if you had a lab set up, run every pitcher that you're possibly going to draft through that biomechanics and say, here, this guy looks good, this guy wouldn't?
Well, yeah, it would be a no-brainer, but at this point, the advisors won't allow it. You can't get any sort of medical testing done. You can't do any sort of anything. You can work them out. You can watch them. There's now questions about video. What can you video? From what angles can you video? What medical records can you access? They've been very, problematic about that. So I would love to see MLB do a combine the way that the NBA and the NFL do, and have one of the things that they do is put everybody through that. I don't see a reason why they couldn't do that. I certainly don't see a reason why they shouldn't do that. And certainly every team could do it as part of their physical process. And certainly, you have to draft a player beforehand, but you don't have to sign them. And we've seen that with cases like Barrett Liu, where a team very literally walked away and knew there were problems and were kind of gaming the system and got slapped on the wrist for it. But, you could protect yourself. And why you wouldn't want this information on your pitchers, I have no idea. But there's 28 teams out there that don't.
I was going to ask you what would stop a team from using this? If it's only $200 per pitcher, I mean, every pitcher in the organization would cost, what, $100,000 at most?
Yeah. And exactly. I don't see why. I think it would be a great investment, an insurance policy, if nothing else. But there's two things. First, a lot of teams don't know what to do with it. They don't have a biomechanist on staff. They've got a pitching coach that knows, old school pitching. They're out there patting somebody on the butt and saying, go get them, and watching them in bullpens and things like that. But, you hand them things like 32 Newton meters and 142 degrees of angle and, 19 degrees of flexion, and they're going to stare at you like I'm talking about nuclear physics. So that's the first thing. Second is, it's tough to change pitchers. For years, Felix Hernandez had that thing where he almost turned his head. He would fling his head to the side. And that's not good for you. You don't want to do that. It was actually throwing off what he was doing and making his mechanics inconsistent. And it took him a while to kind of strengthen his core enough to where he didn't have to do that. But that said, it's pretty tough and pretty ballsy if you're a pitching coach to say, hey, Felix, you're pretty good. Change this. Changing things, even minutely, is really, really difficult. And there are not a lot of pitching coaches that like to do it. There are some guys out there that do. They're often referred to as tinkerers, guys that always want to change the arm slot, guys that want to change foot placement. They tinker with guys' delivery almost constantly. And, the best example of that is John Farrell, now the manager of the Boston Red Sox. When he was pitching coach, man, he loved to tinker. Very smart guy and somebody that understands biomechanics. One of the teams that has a lab but for some reason isn't using it extensively is the Red Sox, and Farrell was a driving force in that. So it's just that I don't think a lot of teams, A, would know what to do with it, and B, the cost. $100,000 to us doesn't sound like much, but teams, I've heard scouts over and over saying that a dollar not spent on payroll is a dollar wasted.
Can a pitching coach, let's say that Yordano Ventura, that they got him to make a change, can a pitching coach really tell those mechanics, that mechanic difference with arm speed and all that during a game? Can he say, is it that recognizable if you're talking about small little motions that pitching coach without those biomechanics in front of him can really tell him, oh, this guy's making this move right now?
Well, there's a couple things you can do. First, yeah, you can see certain things. You'd have to get the right people in there that would understand what they're looking for. Second thing is you can pay high-speed video. There's no reason they can't. And with that, you can make certain calculations and figure out the arm speed, figure out the arm angles. There's a lot of things you can do from high-speed video that you can't from plain old video. There are some people out there that can say they can actually do biomechanics with video. It's not nearly as good, but it's better than what they have now. When you're talking about a full biomechanical analysis, most of the systems are marker systems. You've probably seen guys wired up for video games. They look silly. They got the little bubbles on them, but you come out with a great result. There are actually markerless systems out there now. The technology is catching up quickly, and I think probably in the next 5 years we're going to see that being kind of the gold standard, the way the marker systems are now.
So another Royals pitcher who's having some trouble right now, obviously, is Kyle Zimmer. He's been shut down for 6 to 8 more weeks after not having pitched yet this year. He's got a lat injury, which I think Clayton Kershaw had. I was wondering, is that the same one that Ben Sheets had also a few years back?
I'm sorry, you broke up there.
Oh, the Kyle Zimmer injury. Is he having the same injury issues that, like,
yeah.
I feel like the same one that Ben Sheets had a few years back, too.
You're exactly right.
Okay. The biomechanics, is that something that the Royals could have seen in Kyle Zimmer and made a change prior to last season when he started feeling the shoulder issues?
Yeah, it is something you could see. Again, you know, change is difficult, and so I can't say that it would have saved him, but it certainly would have given the information that it would be at risk. We have to assume it's from pitching. It is something we've seen more and more, and we've actually seen some shifts this year with Clayton Kershaw and Michael Pineda. They've actually injured the teres major, which is a muscle just kind of below and to the outside of the latissimus dorsi. We haven't really seen these before. I've talked to a lot of doctors and athletic trainers around Major League Baseball, and we can't really figure out why. One of the things they think is that, you know, if we make the shoulder stronger, we're making something else the weak link in the kinetic chain. One of the theories about why we're seeing so many elbow injuries is because we're seeing so few shoulder injuries. You know, something's got to give when you put too much force into the system, and you know, the elbow's weak. The elbow is often the weak link because there's not a lot holding it together. There's not a lot of big muscles. There's one major ligament, and you're putting a ton of stress on it over and over. So the lat injuries we're seeing more of, I wouldn't call them common, but players tend to come back from them pretty well. The lat is a huge muscle. It's one of the biggest muscles in the body. It's actually what they use when they have to graft a muscle somewhere else. So you can pretty much live without half your lat. You wouldn't recommend it, and certainly not for a pitcher. But of all the diagnoses you're going to get, it's certainly not the most problematic. It just throws off the timing for Zimmer, somebody who I know the Royals were hoping was going to be up.
Former big league pitcher Mike Boddicker, he hasn't seen Kyle a lot, but he said one problem that he recognized just from photos is that he's overextended on that front foot, and he's extending too far and stepping forward too far. Could you, is that a problem, do you think, that's going to hurt him and cause more injuries?
I hadn't heard Boddicker say that. And what I'd have to ask is, what does he mean? First, I like hearing somebody say that. When teams say, well, we don't know what to do with that biomechanical stuff. Well, there's a guy who sounds like he does. I don't know whether he means the stride length is too long or whether he's too far forward over the stride. Both of those are bad. Certainly not ideal. I don't want to say bad. That's fairly easily correctable. Stride length is one of the things, especially at lower levels, you can correct pretty quickly. The thing with stride length is when you change it, you often throw off the timing. You have to do certain things at the right point in the delivery, and if you try to essentially catch up, you'll put too much force on something. That's when you see valgus stress overload, that's usually what you're seeing, is that the arm is late. You'll see guys like Chris O'Leary talk about the inverted W, which I'm still trying to figure out what is in an M. There's nothing inherently wrong with the inverted W, but it usually leads to poor timing. And so that's what Chris found, and he does great work. It's that timing. If you're off, if you're late, then you're certainly going to have problems. And so changing stride length is easy to do, but it can lead to other problems if you don't fix the timing as well.
Interesting. Now, the Royals say that Kyle Zimmer is structurally intact everywhere. Do you buy that completely?
Structurally intact or no structural damage is probably the most meaningless information they're ever going to get. Because what's a structure? Is it just ligaments? Is a muscle not a structure? When you talk about a lat strain, well, okay, now you have damage in a muscle. A strain, by definition, is, you know, tearing a fiber in the muscle. And that sounds like a structure to me. That sounds like damage. So when somebody tells me that, I want to know more. Obviously, the medical people don't take questions or aren't supposed to due to MLB rules, but I just hate when they say no structural damage. Because usually it isn't true. It's just the structures they want to talk about aren't damaged.
Well, yeah, I mean, first he had bone spurs, then he had shoulder inflammation, which
bones are a structure, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I thought.
And now his muscles in his back are breaking down. I mean, the structure seems like it's collapsing to me.
Yeah, you know, in that one, I don't care what the structure's damaged. Right now, it sounds like the pitcher is damaged. That's the real bottom line.
And then, obviously, you haven't heard much about it today, but Danny Duffy was 87 to about 90 for much of today's game. They said dead arm. Explain to people what a dead arm means.
Dead arm is, you know, again, this is one of those terms that can mean a lot of things. Normally, it just means fatigue, and it's not the worst thing in the world. You know, the easiest explanation, if you go out and run a mile, you know, some people are going to run a mile and barely break a sweat. Some of us are going to be sucking wind, and we're going to be sore the next day. Dead arm tends to just means the muscles have fatigued and are worn out. You get this early in the season. You hear it a lot in spring training, guys that are coming back and they're doing just a little bit too much. The positive of dead arm is that it's, to steal the bad term, it's not structural usually. You're not looking at you've torn a ligament, you've torn a muscle. It's just it's really tired. And off, you learn why they're not recovering well between starts. You change up some systems. Maybe you have to strengthen somebody. Usually it's more focused on stamina. But, you know, dead arm is not the worst thing in the world unless you're just using it as a garbage term to cover up something you know is something more serious. Not saying that's the case here, but teams have done that in the past.
So you say dead arm is not anything to be terribly concerned about. But with a guy who is just recently recovered from Tommy John surgery, does that add any level of concern, or is it totally a separate issue?
It's tough to say. You know, you do worry about shoulder after elbow. The pattern is, again, it's a chain, and there's always going to be a weak link. Well, you just fixed the elbow. Now is it the shoulder? You know, shoulders are really difficult to fix when something goes on inside there. So if it's just that he's tired, that, you know, somewhere in his rehab he didn't build the stamina back up, or that he's just, you know, maybe he's changed the mechanics and he's got some of those small muscles that are just catching up to the new changes, that they haven't been conditioned over all the years he's been pitching. Those are the kind of things that can cause dead arm, and I would actually look at that as a bit of a positive. Stamina and recovery are two things that a medical staff can work on pretty quickly, so that's why I'm normally not too terribly concerned with that. But for a kid with the injury history of Duffy,
obviously a rash of Tommy John injuries just in general, is this due to increased velocity? Is this, a lot of people are saying it's the showcase circuit usage. What's your take on it all?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of everything. I wish I could tell you exactly what it was. I'd be a millionaire. We don't. Is it overuse? Yeah, probably. Is it too much force on the elbow? Yeah, probably. Is it you know, youth pitching? Yeah, probably. Is it velocity? I'm less on velocity, and the reason why is because not every pitcher is the same. If every pitcher had the same strength, if he had the same frame, if he threw the same pitches, then I would say, yeah, it's probably the velocity, because, you know, the simplest thing is if you put more force into the system, you're going to have more force you have to disperse from the system. You know, the laws of physics make it so. The thing that throws that off is not every pitcher is the same. You know, when a small-framed guy like Ventura or Tim Collins can throw in the upper 90s, even 100, then they're getting the force from somewhere. Usually it's the legs. So how are they dispersing that? You know, how much force is going into their elbow? Another thing to consider is how strong is the elbow? Not everybody's ligaments and muscles are going to be of the same strength, and that's something we can't measure at this point. There's just too many things going in there. Look, we could go out to the Kansas Motor Speedway and take a crappy old rusty Chevy Cavalier and run it 100 miles an hour. It, you know, you're not going to be happy about it. It's going to be screaming. The engine's going to be on the edge. You're going to be squealing the tires around every turn. You get in a Ferrari, and, you know, it's like a Sunday drive. You can go around there and not even worry about it, probably do it all day. Some of these pitchers are Ferraris.
some of these pitchers are rusty Chevy Cavaliers. The problem is we don't know how much which is which because we don't have the information. Going back to the biomechanics, it's basically like buying a Ferrari without getting the Carfax. It just doesn't make sense to me to not get as much information as you can to understand how much force is going into the system and how much force is coming out of the system. Velocity is only one part of that calculation. And, you know, are all this Chapman's arms together? We are seeing more and more pitchers throwing harder, and we're not seeing Tommy John surgery just fly through the roof. It's not just those guys. I mean, for God's sakes, Jamie Moyer had Tommy John surgery. Nobody says it's the velocity that did him in. So, you know, there are pitchers out there like Chapman, like Verlander, other guys who have gone, you know, at very high velocity for a long period of time that are healthy. You know, to me, it's devastating that a third of major league pitchers have had Tommy John surgery. But it's just as interesting to me as to ask the question, why two-thirds of them haven't?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's like you said, that's a million-dollar question. If any of us knew that, we wouldn't be sitting here talking to each other probably. So, yeah, well, you know, I think we'll wrap up and let you go because I don't want to keep you too long. But that was really interesting stuff about Royals pitching injuries. So thank you so much, Will, for joining us, and we hope that we don't have to talk about any more Royals injuries with you in the near future.
That's the thing. Everybody goes, yeah, it's great to talk to you. Hope we never have to do it again, Will. Thanks a lot.
We'd love to talk to you, just not about the Royals.
Yeah, we can do injuries of division rivals.
Exactly.
When Chris Sale goes down, we'll talk to you about that.
It's inevitable.
All right, well, thanks a lot, Will.
Thanks a lot, guys.
That was great stuff from Will Carroll, the injury expert. You can follow him on Twitter, @injuryexpert. Read his work at Bleacher Report, see him on MLB Network, just all over the place when it comes to injuries. One thing that really surprised me, not surprised me, but one thing that caught me off guard a little bit, I guess, is that the Royals are just saying conflicting things about Ventura, and I guess it didn't catch me off guard the Royals said that, but it catches me off guard that he was caught off guard by that.
Does it really? I guess it doesn't catch me wrong that he would be. He doesn't follow this team as closely as you and I do, and them saying conflicting things is that goes with the norm.
That's true. And they do that all the time.
Yeah, and he's following 30 other major league teams and apparently quite a few other sports, so he doesn't have the eye on the organization that we do. The thing that ticks me off, and you and I have talked about this off air, is they've got kind of the leaders in this not too far away down in Columbia, Missouri. Kind of like they had the leaders in sabermetrics right there in Kansas City, and yet again, the organization seems to ignore it.
Yeah, and I'm not defending the Royals by any stretch. I don't understand why 28 organizations are ignoring it, let alone the Royals. I mean, yeah, the Cardinals are the same distance from Missouri, University of Missouri, as the Royals are, and they're ignoring it too. And so, I mean, I guess you have to question, is there a reason for that? But I can't see one. I can't see a reason not to spend $200. And I said $100,000 for organization. I did the math in my head. That's even way high. That's 500 pitchers. They don't have that many pitchers in the organization. So,
no, it's...
Actually, that's 500 pitchers. I can't do math. I write. But, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I don't know why you wouldn't take any advantage you can. It's the same thing with Bill James and Rob Nyer and Mike Fast. It's the same thing as Mike Boddicker was talking about with, well, him and David Segee all being in the area, all would jump at the chance to work for the Royals, I would assume. I mean, I know Mike Boddicker would because he told me. I know David told us. I know David Segee would because that's what he told us. And I assume, and Bill James has said he would. So I assume, I kind of feel like if you grew up a Royals fan, you probably work for the team you love. And this is just another thing that the Royals aren't taking advantage of, you're right, in their backyard. And it's maddening to me that they wouldn't take every advantage possible that they could. And you look at a team like the Brewers who do it, and they have not had a single pitcher go down to Tommy John surgery And since they started with this biomechanics program, I think he said on 610 it was 4 or 5 years ago. That's, I mean, yes, there are other injuries, but that's phenomenal. With every team having this rash of injuries, I mean, you look around, it's not just the Royals. The Blue Jays have lost pitchers. The Mets have lost pitchers. The Braves have lost 2 pitchers this year alone for their second Tommy John each. Every team is going through this, but not the Brewers. And the Blue Jays are actually one of the teams who use it. And I think he said they picked it up after the Tommy John surgeries.
I want real quick to talk about the Brewers. Look at their organization. When Jack Z was running that, was in that organization, and their GM, they had a bunch of hitters. They had Prince Fielder, Ryan Braun, Ricky Weeks, Corey Hart, all these bats, and they had no pitching, and they had no way to develop pitching, and they couldn't understand why they couldn't develop pitching. Now this team is overran with pitching. Mm-hmm. They've got, and some of it's, they went out and acquired good deals at the time that it looked like. Going out and getting Kyle Loesch below market value, getting Matt Garza on a perceived good deal. But now they've got, you know, Willy Peralta is dominating. Marco Estrada is doing really well. Gallardo. Yeah. They called up recently, they called up Jimmy Nelson, and he's starting after dominating AAA. That's a guy in-house. They've got their bullpen.
He had a great game, too.
Yeah, and their bullpen has been outstanding. And some of those guys they've acquired in other ways. But they've developed pitching, and they've got more pitching down there. Mike Fiers, who struggled last year, but he's dominating AAA, and he's had one good major league season. He's got nowhere to start on that team.
Yeah.
And
their worst starter is Matt Garza, which is kind of funny to me.
Yeah, I mean, they've got all of a sudden, they've got great pitching, and they've got probably pitching that they'll be able to unload at the deadline. You know, if you're a team that wants to challenge or say you need a starter and Fiers is killing it down in AAA, that's a guy you might go out and acquire and say, here, he could be, maybe he made some adjustments and he can be our fifth starter or something like that.
They have a couple holes, too, because you look at their lineup. They're starting Lyle Overbay a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Second base position with Scooter Gennett. I mean, I don't know if they're going to move on from him because they like him, but he's not having a great season. Ricky Weeks, you could put a package together with Ricky Weeks and one of their pitchers, and they could really get back some offense. They're playing Mark Reynolds a lot at first base also, but I mean, I know he's got power, but he's got a .293 on base percentage. You can't live with that. So you're right. It's one of those things. They're overrun with pitching, and they seem to be going about it a different way than most other teams. And I think that we might see here in the next 3 to 5 years the Brewers becoming the it team, the new Rays, so to say, with a little higher payroll.
Yeah, if they can, all they got to do is put some bats in there. Their bullpen is stacked right now. I mean, they're solid, just solid pitching team, and they've got enough bats in the National League to hang on to this lead. I mean, when you got Carlos Gomez playing at an MVP level and Ryan Braun, that's probably enough offense when you mix in Chris Davis against on the side of that he's better on. He's really good against what, right-handers, I think, or left-handers. He's really good against left-handers. And then, you know, Lou Croy's very good hitting catcher. It's, mm-hmm. They got some stuff to work with. And
they could be an interesting target for the Royals, actually, in terms of a trade that mm-hmm. I hadn't really thought of until just this very moment. But, I mean, the Royals could use some starting pitching depth, first of all. But I wonder if the Royals would be willing to listen to offers on Eric Hosmer. I think they should, personally. I don't know that they would, but you know, I wonder if there's a guy in their system who, I don't know, maybe it's Hunter Morris, who they could get with some pitching for Eric Hosmer, and that could solidify the Brewers' first base position.
I don't know. I don't know if the Royals would want to make that trade. You know, another
they probably
guy that
wouldn't.
Would...
Is the thing. Just me kind of talking out loud as I'm looking at their roster and we're talking.
Well, why not? Why not for them? If you're Chris Davis, why not go out and acquire Alex Gordon to man left field?
Yeah,
you've improved your left field defense. You also get him a little bit.
Although Davis is starting to hit now.
Well, But he doesn't, you know, he's not as consistent. He's really good, like I said, against lefties, but he's not great against, you know, right-handed pitching.
Sure.
So, I mean, well, he crushes lefties. Yeah, I mean, you can platoon him a little bit there and give Alex some days off, as Alex is getting up there in age. He can use a few days off, but you improve your defense even more because now you got Alex Gordon and Carlos Gomez, probably the two best center field and left fielders in the league.
Yeah.
And you get
and that would be the only place Gordon could go where he'd play with a better center fielder than he does now.
Exactly. And maybe you can play Alex a little bit of first base as well, or maybe you can play Chris Davis a little bit of first base.
No, that's a good point.
And so that trade would make a lot of sense. I don't know what the Brewers would be willing to give up, but I think the team's meshed pretty well, like you said, with pieces, or maybe they think Billy Butler could hit in their park,
and they can
live with his first base defense.
Which isn't as terrible as people think. It's not good. No doubt about that. But it's not awful, awful.
No, it's not god awful. But
it's interesting, and I don't know. I really enjoyed listening to what Will Carroll had to say about injuries. I think very, very interesting follow. There's a lot going on in the pitching injury world that he's kind of breaking down, and then there's another book coming out. Jeff Passan's currently writing a book about it, and I'm looking forward to reading that. It's an interesting field that I don't think we know enough answers to just yet.
Well, that's what I like about Will, is he doesn't profess to have an answer.
Right.
Where exactly. Some of the other guys seem like they think they know, or they're saying that
they're too hard.
Well, yeah. Maybe.
Probably not, maybe. I don't know.
Nolan Ryan threw hard for a long time. Yeah. That's the thing. There's a new fad. First it was the inverted W. Then it was long toss. Now it's showcasing and velocity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's the facts that pitchers are getting injured. No one really knows what the key is. But you know what? There's one team out there that doesn't seem to be having the injuries that everybody else does. So, and before that,
let's do what they're doing.
Yeah, let's do what they're doing, or let's at least examine what they're doing and seeing. You know, sometimes it's just luck. The Rays, I think, had a lot of luck.
They had a run.
They had a nice run. Their guys weren't getting injured, and maybe they were doing things right too.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We know this. The Royals are doing something wrong, and they better eventually. They better admit it. I mean, that's the thing. Is through all of this, they've stood firm and saying we're not doing anything wrong. Well, no, you
obviously are.
Yeah, your guys break down in the minors at a pretty high rate. Your guys break down in the majors at a pretty high rate. You might not be doing something totally wrong, but you could be better than what you're doing.
Right, and this is not to say that they're the only team. There are a lot of teams doing things wrong.
Yeah.
The issue is that a lot of those teams who are doing things wrong have the money to cover it up. The Royals can't afford to be doing things wrong. The reason the A's win is because they do things right. The reason the Yankees win is because they can do things wrong and cover it up with money. There's a big difference. Let's be real. I mean, you can afford to do things wrong if you have money. But if you don't have money, you've got to be right. And the Brewers don't have a terribly, terribly high payroll. They're higher than the Royals. The Rays don't have a high payroll. They're struggling this year. But, I mean, wouldn't you take 1 year of struggling after their success?
Mm-hmm.
The A's are year in and year out good because they do everything right. The Twins have struggled for the last 3 years, but they're starting to put it together again because they do things the right way. I don't love their pitching program, but it worked for them. They're not the greatest example. The other three are better. But, yeah, you can't afford to not take every relatively inexpensive advantage you can find, and the Royals aren't doing that. And other teams are.
No, that's the thing. They could tweak some things and do some things better and make the team better in other ways and gain advantages. It could be the Brewers and gain an advantage. Sabermetrics, they could have gained advantages. And that's where the difference of, I'm not going to put all of that on Dayton Moore. I think that comes down to David Glass. And maybe Will Carroll, what he said there was correct. That teams think that any dollar spent not towards payroll is a dollar wasted.
Yeah.
Well, that's incorrect thinking. And other businesses will show you that. There's a, you know, there's a way to do things correctly. Sometimes a dollar spent is a dollar, you're going to get 10 times that back.
Well, it's like magazine advertising for a business. Sometimes you can't track it, but you know that it's helping your bottom line.
Exactly.
Sometimes, I mean, you do these $200 biomechanic reviews, and you can't see where the money is helping. But if you look closely, well, we knew to trade that guy in single A when his value was as high as it'll ever be, or we knew that this guy's not going to break down, so let's hold on to him, or we knew not to draft this guy and give him a $5.7 million signing bonus or something along those lines. And what boggles my mind is that it's only $200.
No, it's ridiculous. Well, it's only $1 million. I mean, they could build their own lab, he said, for $1 million.
Well, right. But
Dave, $1 million. Think about that. Think about how long that's stretching. You're going out spending $1 million. That might last them 20 years.
Well, sure, but for $200 a pop, if there's 150 pitchers in the organization, which is probably about right, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's probably in that ballpark.
That's $30,000 a year. You know how long it would take to get to $1 million on that? It's 33 years. Yeah. So the fact is they don't have to build their own facility. All they've got to do is give $30,000 a year to the University of Missouri Biomechanics Facility and have them look at every pitcher. And you have to do every pitcher. I mean, really, do you really care about the biomechanical review on James Shields? No. He's gone for this year anyway. Mm-hmm. And look at prospects in Wilmington. How, really, do you need to spend $200 on this guy? Probably not. This guy, probably not. You know, there are guys you don't care about, but you go in with Miguel Amonte, Yordano Ventura, Sean Manaea, Kyle Zimmer. You take them in, you probably end up spending $20,000 a year in reality, which lasts you 50 years on $1 million. And, I mean, I imagine at some point in those 50 years, the price will go up to $250. But it boggles my mind that something that inexpensive is something that teams are not willing to do.
Yeah. Instead, they'll go out and spend, you know, a couple $100,000 on a kid in the to play in the Carolina League that they signed in the fifth round that'll never make it.
Right, exactly. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm getting frustrated. We should bring in C.J. Whitman before I start to fly off the handle completely.
Yeah, let's bring in C.J. and talk about some of those fifth-round Carolina League prospects that'll never make it. We're joined by C.J. Whitman of Baseball Prospectus, and he's on the Prospectus prospect team. Thanks, C.J., for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me on. It's a pleasure.
CJ, obviously you're in the Carolina League region. I think you're what? You're a Jersey boy like your cousin?
Yes, I am. Me and Zach were about 10 minutes apart over in New Jersey. I'm about 15 minutes from the Delaware Bridge and 20 minutes from the ballpark. It's very convenient.
Yeah, so you get to see a ton of the players at Wilmington. Tell us about the changes that you've seen in Bubba Starling from the start of the year to now.
I've always been a believer in the high upside tools guys, and Bubba definitely fits that mold. I mean, the tools, they just scream at you when you see him. He's a very physical presence there. I love him in center field. I think the glove plays plus, and the arm is plus. I mean, he's tracked down some balls that I thought that nobody else would be able to field, and then Bubba's just ran them down. Early in the season, Bubba was struggling, obviously. I mean, he's still struggling a little bit, but he's been much better. The approach was really bad early in the season. He was swinging at pitches that were never even close to the strike zone. He wasn't picking up spin and everything. And I'm a big believer in it's a neurological thing if you can pick up spin and track pitches. And Bubba hasn't really shown that in the past, but recently, you know, he's been much better. I've seen, you know, big improvements in him on picking up spin and being very selective at the plate. I think in his last 10 games, he's got a couple of walks, but he was hitting like somewhere around 300 the last 10 games with like a 350 OBP, which is a big improvement for him. And I've seen him a lot work with the new hitting coach over there, Mel Thompson, who was the Phillies hitting coach not that long ago. And I think it was more or less a thing where they told him, you know, in this area of the plate, Bubba, you can't hit that pitch. But in this area of the plate, you can hit that pitch. And now I've seen Bubba lay off a lot of pitches on the outside part of the plate, and then everything on the inside he's turning on right now. I really think it was just, you know, they told him, instead of making him a mechanical robot, they told him just to go out and play. And that's what he's been doing lately, and he's been showing off the tools. You know, he's got some stolen bases. I don't think he's been thrown out yet. You know, playing the good center field, like I said, I think his average is almost up to 200 now. You know, Frawley Stadium's a huge stadium. There's not many home runs hit there, but it's a good doubles park. And Bubba's got a couple of doubles. I saw him one of the games that I saw Bubba play. The in-game adjustments that he's been making have been impressive to me the last, you know, 10, 15 games or so. One of the in-game adjustments that I took note of was, you know, outer half, outer half, outer half. That's where everybody was beating him. He rolled over two pitches early in the game that were ground out to shortstop where he could have drove it to right field, maybe to the right field gap or down the line. Late in the game, Bubba had been fed the same pitch, fastball outside, you know, curveball outside, changeup outside. He waits on the pitch, works the count to 3-2, then drives the fastball out of Frawley Stadium, which was – it was a shock. So that was just something that's really impressing me with Bubba. I would love to see this over a larger sample. I'm not going to jump the gun and say that he's made, you know, drastic improvements, and I think he's a top prospect now. But if he can continue this over the course of the season, I think that we'll see, you know, maybe he repeats in high A. But if he keeps progressing, I definitely think that he could get much closer to the ceiling than a lot of people project.
What kind of impact has Milt Thompson had on some of the other players, if he's had that kind of that big of a mental impact, I guess, on Bubba?
Right, yeah. I took note of stuff that I've seen from different hitters from early in the season, like Hunter Dozier, for example. I'm really high on him, and I was high on him before. He's going on a tear the last 10 games. I don't know if you guys seen that, but he's hitting somewhere of like 450 with like a 560 OBP and slugging almost 600 the last 10 or so games. But with Dozier, it was almost the same thing where he wasn't being selective at the plate. And then when he did get his pitch, he was driving the ball, which wasn't, that's not what Bubba was doing, but that's what Dozier was doing. He was driving the ball on anything that he could hit. The last month or so, Dozier's been much more selective at the plate. He's laid off some tough pitches, and I've seen him drive the ball probably 15 times right at people at Frawley. I mean, he's not hitting well at Frawley. I have his splits right here. He's hitting 226 with a 340 OBP and a 260 slug. But away from Frawley, he's hitting 324 with a 443 OBP and slugging 450. I mean, his last 10 games, he's hit 448, 526 OBP and slugging 568. And it's just been over the course of the season. I think the adjustment period for him was a little bit longer. I think he had the same problem when he had went to wherever he went last year. What's the short season
team? Idaho Falls.
Right, yeah, where he went to Idaho. He had a little bit of longer adjustment period, and then once he got in his groove, I think he led the league in doubles, and he wasn't even there for the end of the year. So I think it's more of a mental aspect with approach and pitch selection with all these hitters, where Dozier, I believe, has it neurologically. He tracks spin really well. He tracks everything out of the hand. He sees the ball early. He's been much more selective since the beginning of the year, and it's really starting to show here. I think he's only got 6 strikeouts in his last 10 games with 6 walks. So he's a guy that was striking out a lot more in the beginning of the year. Now he's worked up to 29 walks to 43 strikeouts, so it's starting to even out a little bit. And he's made a lot of improvements. And I think not just Dozier, but Mondesi, who's actually been hurt the last couple of games, which has made me sad because Mondesi's my favorite guy ever. But early in the season, it was the same problem, just not – you know, recognizing spin down has been the MO on him. You know, feed him spin down, and he'll strike out. But now, before the injury, I don't think he's played since May 16th, I want to say. But before the injury, he was, you know, much more selective at the plate, and it was working counts and working pitchers, and not just drawing walks, but having quality at-bats where he would drive the ball to the gap, even though it was caught, it was still a quality at-bat. Another guy that's jumped out to me the last couple of games is Cam Gallagher. I don't know if a lot of people are high on him, but I like Gallagher. I think you know, he could be a serviceable backup at the major league level. I think he's like more of like a role four, role 45 guy than a top prospect. But behind the plate, he's, you know, solid average defense, solid average arm. I have him in like the 1.9, 1.95 pop time area. At the plate, it's where the hit tool won't play. I mean, the raw power is probably like a 6, but I don't think the hit tool utility allows that to play to the highest level. But, you know, lately Gallagher's been driving the ball, and he's been really selective at the plate. He's drawn a couple of walks. He's, you know, come up clutch in some situations for them the last couple of games that I've been to. But Gallagher's just a guy that's really worked on his approach, and I think that was the biggest thing with him was approach, approach, approach. And it's something that, you know, he's really worked on. He's not striking out a bunch now. He's up to 294 the last 10 games with a 316 OBP and slugging 441. He's got a lot of doubles in that park. You know, I like Gallagher. He's an interesting guy.
You talk about some of the hitters that you've seen. What about the pitching side? I know Christian Benford's been outstanding for that club, but what have you seen on the other pitchers as well?
Benford has been outstanding, and I've caught like 3 of his starts. I'm a Benford guy. I'm a Benford fan. I think, you know, he fits well into the back end of the rotation type guy. He has a major league out pitch. He has a slider that sits in like, you know, close to the 82 to 85 range with some tilt. It's got a, you know, good hard bite to the end of it. I said it could be a potential plus pitch at the highest level. He shows, you know, show me curveball, which more of a change of pace pitch than a weapon, and he has a decent changeup that I like. It's in, you know, the 82 to 85 range. Sometimes he can get firm with it, but it works off. It plays very well off his fastball. His fastball sits in the 90 to 94 range. He usually settles in like 91, 92 over the course of the game. He's a big, tall guy, and he throws downhill. He uses his body well. He gets a little deliberate and stiff in his delivery at times, but he repeats very well. I'm a Benford fan, and they have another guy there that I've seen quite a few times, Sean Manaea. I've seen him about almost every single start, I think, since he's been in Wilmington. I'm a Manaea fan, and the thing is with him is I see a lot of people, you know, tweet me and stuff like that, and, you know, the numbers don't match up, you know, what you're projecting, and I think it's an adjustment period, and there's always going to be an adjustment period for every player. And, you know, lately his last couple or early in the season, he was getting knocked around a little bit. You know, sometimes he wouldn't make it through 3 times through the lineup or even 2 times through the lineup. But with Manaea, he needs to locate his fastball for his other stuff to play. And the thing with his fastball is I've seen it in the 88 to 91 range, and I've also seen it in the 93 to 95 range. But everywhere he throws it, it misses bats. It's a ghost ball, like, you know, Jason Parks has said on one of the Fringe Average podcasts, that it just disappears when it gets to the plate. It gets on hitters quick. He has very good deception in his delivery. You know, once he establishes the fastball, he loves throwing it to the glove side, which is good for a lefty, and in a developmental path, it's really good that a pitcher can establish the glove side before the arm side. He loves throwing it to the glove side, which I like to see a lot. I love his slider. He throws a slider that ranges. It can get soft. It can be a harder type break. It's like it works from 78 to 86 range, where he'll show, you know, a 78 to 81 slider that has a bigger bite. A bigger break with some bite. He'll show that for a strike, and then he'll throw one in the 83 to 85 range that's hard. It's tight. You know, that's a strikeout pitch. That's the one that he throws real hard down in the dirt. I like his changeup too. It's good stuff. It works in the 80 to 84 range. Has a parachute action, I like to call it. He pulls the string really well on it. It plays extremely well with his fastball because he has that deception, and because he can spot his fastball, and the fastball works in a higher velocity. Obviously, it plays off because of the same arm action and everything. I think both his slider and his changeup will project to be plus at the highest level. And even though his fastball may not be, in terms of velocity, a plus pitch, I think that the reason, you know, he gets swing and misses on it, obviously, is the deception and the movement of the pitch and his ability to spot it. I think that plays at plus at the highest level, too. So we're talking about a guy that has 3 plus pitches at the highest level. I like Manaea as the number 2, number 3 type starter. I mean, he's pitched 36 and two-thirds innings this year. He struck out 53. I mean, his ERA obviously isn't great, 4.91, but, I mean, he's striking out, you know, close to, 12, 13 guys in an outing if you go over 9 innings. And that's really impressive to me. Another guy also, Miguel Almaniec. He's one of my favorites. I saw him the other day. He was really amped up. He was ready to go. You know, fastball velocity was a little bit higher. Sat 94, 96 with some late movement. I really love, you know, the movement of the fastball. His mechanics allow him to throw his changeup and his new curveball from the same arm slot. You know, he generates a lot of arm speed. He's a very fast arm. His curveball last year is not the curveball that I've seen this year. It's much improved. It works from the 70 to 80 mile an hour velocity band. It shows really good shape, 11.5 shape. Sometimes you can get soft with it, and it can lose, you know, a couple miles an hour velocity, and it'll get slurvy, and it'll be a slow break. But right now, when he has it on, I mean, it's on. It has massive snap, hard bite to it. I thought for Amani when I saw him last year, that's what the last stage for him was, because his changeup is a money pitch. That projects as a 7 for me. I mean, he loves to throw it, too. It works, you know, 82 to 85. Big deception, very good arm side fade with some deep vertical action on it. He loves throwing it down. He loves throwing it in any count, too, which is very impressive to me also. But the last stage for Almaniec, I thought, was developing a breaking ball. He had a slider and a curveball last year. He needed to either focus on one of them and only throw the other one as a change of pace, maybe. Or I just thought that they blended too much for a guy that was young and needed a more development in the curveball. Well, I'm almost positive he ditched his slider, because I haven't seen one this year, and the curveball has been on for me. I mean, I think it's going to be solid average. It could possibly play to plus with command improvement. You know, it's probably the most developed pitch that I've ever seen from a year to another year. I mean, last year it only worked maybe 74, 76. It was really slurvy type break. It almost blended the two breaking balls, and now it's a harder velocity. I had talked to a player development guy for the Royals, and he had said that they advised him to throw it as hard as he can. You know, throw it if it has the shape and if it has the bite, throw it as hard as you can, and we'll work from there. And that's what he's been doing. It has a velocity spike, and it's looked really good. I really like it.
Can you explain what's going on with Almonte, why he's giving up so many home runs with all that good stuff going on?
That puzzles me also, because he's striking out over 9 per. The thing is with him is I've seen Almaniec hit glove side spots, arm side spots, glove side spots, arm side spots. I mean, just painting the corners and everything is down and he looks great. And then one inning I've seen him where he walks 3 guys and then makes a mistake pitch and he gives up a bomb, you know. I think it's more or less getting into a groove and staying within that groove and, you know, working on the location and everything. I think that's just not saying that it's bad luck, but I think it's where he loses mechanics, he'll walk a few guys, and then he'll give up that home run, and then he'll give up that bases clearing double. It's to the point where, you know, I still love Amani. I'm not worried about the ERA and all that kind of stuff, but he is walking some guys, and that's the thing with him. He needs to improve the command profile, and that's with his fast arm and his mechanics. He repeats well, but sometimes the front side opens up a little bit, causes the arm to drag. You know, balls tend to sail on him. He misses arm side spots most outings. You know, I think that's the thing with him. He's a young guy. He just turned 21. It's a big developmental path for him. He's still got a lot of time to develop. I think he definitely stays the whole year in high A. We could even see him start there next year, too, and then eventually move up to the double-A level. With improved command, I think we'll see even the strikeout numbers could even go up more. I think the home runs, you know, he's given up 6 this year in 49 innings. I don't think that's going to continue at that rate. He's got 16 walks in 49 innings. I would hope that doesn't continue at that rate either. I definitely think the command profile needs to improve. Right now, I have it presently below average. I think, you know, with reps, with repetition and pitch sequence and spotting to the arm side more, I think he can get to solid average at the highest level. You know, there's a big difference in where Amani is now and where he needs to be successful at the major league level. And for a 21-year-old kid in high A, I don't expect him to be, you know, a number 2 starter right now in the major leagues. But I think, you know, the command profile improvement, I love his curveball now. It's definitely a usable third pitch. I think it's going to be really good at the highest level. I think he does get to the number, you know, three starter in the rotation by when it's all said and done.
What does the you talk about command profile. Is Benford, is he winning on command right now? Or is this kid, does he have this stuff? Because we've seen other Royals pitchers get to high A and have great seasons based on mostly on command.
Right, and that was the thing. I talked to somebody about this too. I think it's a combination of both. Benford's command is really good for me. Every time that I've seen him, you know, he's hit a lot of arm side spots, a lot of glove side spots. He loves throwing the slider away to righties. He lives down with his changeup. I don't think I've ever seen him leave a changeup up for a mistake pitch. You know, I saw him against Winston-Salem last month where he pitched, I think, 7 innings, punched out 10, and gave up one or two hits, maybe 3 at the most. You know, he's a guy that does live off command, but I also think that he has the stuff, too. I love his slider. I think it's going to be a plus pitch at the highest level. His fastball has some run. It sits at a good velocity, 90 to 94. That's going to work for a guy that's 6 hits, especially when he throws downhill like that. Like I said, I think it's a combination of both, but I do think that Benford's going to continue. I'm not saying that he's going to punch out 10 or 11, you know, per 9 at the highest level, but I do think that he continues his success.
I have an odd question, but who on the Wilmington roster do you think would be most – could make the majors that would still surprise you the most? So, a guy like Kenny Diacrover, who's probably not going to make it. Don't count him. I'm talking about guys who have a real shot.
Okay. That's a good question because I like a guy named Jack Lopez. You know, he played shortstop for them last year, and I wasn't sold that he was going to end up he was going to stay there. Obviously, with Mondesi coming up, he's moved over to second base. He's got some bat-to-ball skills. You know, I don't love the bat speed. I think it's more average than above average, but, you know, he's hitting right now 240 with a 280 on base percentage. I'm not saying he's going to be a star at the highest level, but I definitely wouldn't be surprised if he makes it. He's only 21 years old. He's got to play second base to get there, which I think that he will. I like his defense. I think his glove plays solid, average to plus there. His arm's actually okay. He definitely doesn't have any trouble turning double plays or anything like that. But away from Frawley Stadium, he's hitting 292 with a 320 on base and slugging 375. I definitely think this is a guy that you could see is slide into that role four utility type guy.
You talk about, explain to people why you have so much love for Raul Mondesi and the people that have seen him, like myself, that we do have that. Explain to them what kind of player he is.
All right, this is, I actually wrote him up for Baseball Prospectus when we just came out with our eyewitness stuff. I understand that the numbers may not match my projection currently, but this is a kid that's 18 years old in high A playing a all-star level shortstop. He last year, I wasn't completely sold that the glove would play to a 6 or a 7 type grade on the scouting scale. But with repetition and his improvements in the offseason, he's put on a little bit of weight, actually. He looks good. He looks very good physically. I love Mondesi's glove, that shortstop. I mean, he's got instincts that are absolutely off the charts. He is very instinctual out there, like I said. But he makes plays that I can't explain it to you. I mean, I've seen hard shots up the middle where I'm like, oh, that's a no-doubt single. And Mondesi makes a play, spins, and throws the guy out. I mean, that's the appeal to him is the glove's going to play very well there. He has a very strong arm. And at the plate from both sides, I like the swing path and the bat speed. Right now, you know, he's only hitting 250 with a 307 on-base percentage, and he struck out 40 times this year. But I believe that it will improve, and it can play to – a plus grade while his power could even develop more. I think he's still got a lot of room to fill out. I love the bat speed and the swing plane. He barrels everything. I mean, I've seen him barrel, you know, plus off speed and plus velocity. Presently, his trouble would spin down a little bit, but I think that's something when he develops, he'll be able to lay off or he'll be able to track it even better. One thing with Mondesi, too, is with the added weight, last year I had him in the 55 to 65 runner when he was going to be a full maturity. He's a 7 runner for me now. I've got him at 388 and 394 from the left side on jailbreak bunts, but I've got him at like a 3.57 on a double. I clocked him at a 10.5 on a triple. I mean, he's just flying now. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the added strength. Maybe he's, you know, his lower half's a little bit more healthy than last year or something. I don't know, but he's just ripping around the bags. He's 7 stolen bases, 0 caught stealing. I think that this is a guy that could end up being a 270 with a 325-ish OBP where he hits 10, 15 bombs at the highest level and steals 25 bags a year while playing all-star caliber shortstop. You know, as an 18-year-old kid now in high A, the upside is it's high, and that's my take on Bravo Monsi, and I feel really strongly about that. Even though we could see him maybe repeat the high A level next year, which I don't have a problem with. He's only 18. He's definitely below the age curve, and I think it's just all about development with him.
One question that I see a lot from a couple people actually, which is kind of odd to me, is why is Zane Evans getting the majority of the starts at DH instead of catcher over Gallagher? Why aren't they splitting them a little bit more? Do they see Gallagher as a more likely fit as catcher?
I do think that. I think that they definitely see Gallagher as the catcher there. And I don't mind Zane Evans behind the plate, but I do think that Gallagher is, you know, possibly a full grade better than him behind there. He has a stronger arm. I have better pop times for Gallagher. Evans was actually a guy that I saw early in the year get smashed by a Joey Gallo backswing. So I'm not sure if that plays a role in it, but it really could. I mean, Gallo swung and missed at a pitch that was down. So Evans was reaching for it, and Gallo came back with a backswing that actually hit him below, like, where his helmet was, where it could get protected. And he had a concussion. He missed a few games. I'm not sure if that plays into the catching decision now, if Gallagher had said, you know, maybe he doesn't want to catch, or maybe they feel that it's not safe if he gets hit in the head again if he catches. But early in the season, it was mostly Gallagher catching and Evans DH, and I think that's what we're going to continue to see. Gallagher definitely profiles better for me as the catcher, you know, solid average defense behind there. He blocks really well. He receives really well. He's a strong wrist back there. He's very good with pitch framing and a solid average to plus arm. He's in, like, the 1.9 range for pop times, and that's not where Evans has been.
Name you mentioned in there was Joey Gallo. Explain to people the kind of power this guy has.
Oh, my goodness. Joey Gallo, I saw him play early in the season, and I jumped on board. From what I saw from him last year to this year, it's worlds different. I mean, he's always going to have the swing and miss in his swing, but I read an article where he worked with Troy Tulowitzki and Jason Giambi, I think, on approach and pitch selection and, you know, being almost passive-aggressive at the plate, where if it's not his pitch to drive, he can take a strike now. He doesn't have to swing through it or swing early in the count. And Gallo he is an outlier on the raw power chart. I mean, he's got 80 power, but if there was a higher scale, it would be like 90 power. I mean, he's like Billy Hamilton speed for power. I mean, he puts on an absolute show in BP. I saw one series when they came to Wilmington, Gallo hit 11 home runs in one BP session, and I don't think my jaw was off the ground the whole time. I mean, he hit bomb after bomb after bomb. And the thing is with him, his approach is so much better this year. He's got 44 walks in 164 at-bats. So, you know, close to 200 plate appearances, but he's got 44 walks. And he's hitting .323. He's got an on-base percentage of .463, and he's slugging .738. I know early in the year when Gallo was slugging like .900, I think his slugging percentage would have ranked like fourth in the whole Carolina League for OPS. I mean, he's just tearing the cover off the ball on pitches that he can hit. He's got 18 home runs so far. Another thing with Gallo, I'll tell you this story. It was an Amani start. Gallo hit a bunch of home runs in BP. He looked like he was just in a zone. And Amani came with 94 in the inner half for ball one. Then he threw him 93-mile-an-hour fastball, missed his spot, obviously, you know, middle, belt high. Gallo hits one opposite field home run to left center. I say, oh, well, you know, I expect that from Gallo on a mistake pitch. His next at bat, he comes on with runners on first and second. He takes two changeups down for strike one and ball one that were away. Something that he probably could have drove, but in the situation, he needs to hit the ball to the right side. Amani comes back inside with a fastball, 93. Gallo turns on it, hits a single behind the runners, hit both advance. You know, I thought that was something from Gallo. And then his last at-bat against Amani, which was the sixth inning, Almonte tries to amp one up. I mean, he threw the front side through, arm came through fast, 95, started at Gallo's hip, ended up on the inside corner. Gallo just opened his hips up and just absolutely unloaded on this pitch. I mean, furthest ball I've ever seen hit. If you've ever been to Wilmington Stadium, they have a double fence where it's 380 to right center, then they have a fence that sits behind it, probably 10 feet. Then they have a 60-foot scoreboard above that. Gallo hits this ball over the scoreboard in right center, and it literally got lost into the night. I mean, it was just an absolute bomb. You know, he's got just power that's off the charts. And I think with the improvements in his approach and his hit tool, he's recognizing pitches much better now. And I think that his hit tool could play to like a 250, 260 range at the highest level, but that's going to allow his power to play, you know, to the nth degree. He's going to be a guy that could seriously hit 40 home runs a year.
So how did the Royals go about acquiring one of these Joey Gallos you speak of?
Yeah, I don't know. If they could, I'm sure that they would. I would say Joey Gallo is untouchable. But if every team could acquire Joey Gallo, I would bet every team would acquire Joey Gallo.
Mm. Yeah, well, hopefully someday the Royals actually get one.
It would sure be nice, I'll tell you that much.
Well, CJ, thanks for coming on. I'm sure we'll have you on later in the year to talk about more what you've seen and how the players have adjusted.
Definitely. Thank you. I really appreciate it, guys.
Tell everybody thanks, where CJ. They can follow you and read you.
You can read my stuff over at Baseball Prospectus. I do a lot of the eyewitness accounts. And on Twitter, you can follow me at CJWITTJR at CJ Witt Jr. I'd appreciate some more followers. I got to pass my cousin. He retired Twitter at like 2100. I need to pass him.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you later, man.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it, guys.
He's really high on a lot of the prospects. And from the guys he talked about, there's a reason to be high on them. I've seen a lot of them, and they've flashed big stuff. And it's just at that level, it's just about refining some things.
Yeah, there's a few people listening to this who will probably say that if he's high on a Royals prospect, then he's probably just high. But, yeah, I think there's a – I think with good reason. I think the Royals have some hope down low on the farm. But St. Clint, you know where the Royals have even more hope?
Where is that?
It's in the draft because those guys haven't even had a chance to fail in the organization yet.
Oh, exactly.
And here's something interesting. Did you know that the draft is next week?
Yes, it is. It's next Thursday. And
did you know also that we are going to do a Google Hangout for the draft?
That we are. No podcast via the downloadables, via Stitcher or SoundCloud. We are going to do a live Google Hangout, you and I, during the draft, talking about the players that the Royals take. And I think they have, what, three picks on that very first day?
Yeah. 17, 28, and 40.
Yeah. So we'll have instant analysis, and we are hoping to, not that day, but on this very podcast later on this year, we will talk about those players that get drafted with a member of the front office staff. So we will be all over the draft like we have been on Pine Tar Press as it is. You can go to the draft/college area of our site and review all the guys that we've written up, and we've written up quite a few. I think we ended up writing up, what, over 40 guys?
Yeah, I think so. And that's without picking, like, the top 10 prospects.
Yeah, I mean, we
because
tossed
Because there's no
up.
Chance they're going to fall. So.
Yeah, we specifically didn't write about those guys because we could have wrote about Brady Aiken and Carlos Rodon sure. and told you guys about those, but what's the point?
Royals aren't getting them.
Yeah, we know the Royals aren't drafting them. You can read about them other places. There's tons of other places to find that. So we wrote about the guys that we feel that are probably in the, you know, like the, there's probably some top 10 picks in there, but the rest of them are 10 to 40 range. And I think there's a good chance that we probably wrote about at least three guys that the Royals are going to take.
Yeah, I think so. We'll talk about them with you live next Thursday, I believe. Yes, Thursday. So it'll be June the 5th.
Yep, June 5th. And so that will be posted on our site, where you can join the hangout and come out and join Dave and I as we chat about the Major League Draft. And that's something that Greg and I did prior, and it's really fun. And
well, one thing I'll say, just a warning to everybody listening, it is a BYOB party, so we're not providing any liquor or anything. Just bring your own, bring enough for Clinton and me too, because we're going to mooch.
Yeah, we're going to. Well, I don't know about mooch, but we are definitely going to be drinking and celebrating the new prospects to the system, I guess.
And we also have a mock draft coming out, one picks 1 through 40. It'll be coming out, I believe, next week.
Yeah, speaking of that, Dave, you have the next pick that you need to make. So.
Oh, do I? Well, then.
So we'll end the podcast so Dave can make that pick, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
See you around.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.